Let's keep going with these strategies. Next strategy for handling imposter syndrome is sharing. This is along the lines of what I was talking about before. When we have people come to workshops and they stand up the front and talk about the skeleton that they've had in the closet, I'm not suggesting that for you, but what I am suggesting is that there are people that you can talk to, and there are people who will, who are committed to not judging you. And those, the two categories are basically friends that you know who will do that, and mentors who understand that they need to do that. It doesn't matter which one it is, and it doesn't matter that the mentor understands that this is a process where they need to suspend judgment. They still manage to do that. And my experience in mentoring and coaching is that it teaches me a lot about myself when I need to suspend judgment because I'm in a professional capacity. So I'm going to recommend it to you as a thing for you to work with, both for your own benefits and for the benefits of others. And that is that if you've got people you can share with, it's important that you keep doing that. You know, it's kind of one of the things I've noticed over the long-term relationship with Mary is that the relationship goes better when I get on the front foot with sharing. And of course, what I mean by sharing is, you know, I'm feeling vulnerable. And, you know, we've been through a lot the last few years, like all of us have, but, you know, the relationship is stable and ought to be after that period of time. But what I mean is that it gets better when I talk about where I'm wobbly in my life, in what I'm trying. And so you guys would know that, you know, we've been doing this renovation on our farm, which we sold just before Christmas. And so sharing with Mary that I felt inadequate to the task on the renovation, and then that I, you know, going to her one day not too long ago and saying I feel a bit weird because I don't have a place to call my own, but I think that there's something wrong with that thinking, that was just sharing uncertainty. And I think that, you know, that the benefits to the relationship are profound. Whether I'm experiencing uncertainty or not, well, that's just that. That's just, you know, that's just the circumstances of life. What I'm saying is that when we share, what we do is that we don't just make the circumstance of life better, we also deepen the relationship with those that we're sharing with, and in particular, we deepen the relationship with ourselves. So I'm going to suggest to you that whether it's with a mentor, whether it's with a friend, sharing is a really powerful way of moving yourself forward because it helps us to be real. When we know that we can be real, then, and that's really basically when we know that we're not going to get judged, then it gives us the opportunity to deepen the relationship with ourselves. And that's the really important thing, is deepening the relationship with yourself. You'll know, of course, that if you're sharing with a mentor, then the chances are they have experiences that you don't have, or knowledge that you don't have, or just an external view that you don't have, that means that they also have the capacity to do some reassuring. They also have the capacity to kind of say, yeah, having been there, you don't need to be as concerned about it as you are, or you should be more concerned about it than you are, whichever way it goes. So that can take the scariness out of a lot of situations. Does that make sense to you guys? Any questions, thoughts, or whatever's on that one?
Yeah, look, I think, Paul, the thing for me in my coming out of a 42-year relationship where I wasn't really comfortable being vulnerable is yep. that for me, part of me moving on and making this new relationship work is for me to actually trust the fact that I can be vulnerable with Kalesi and talk to her about stuff that, you know, that we need to talk about it, you know, because I think one of the issues in the previous relationship was that whole thing about vulnerability. And that's why I like the Brené Brown stuff, because, you know, I just listened to Daring Greatly, and it is about, you know, it's okay to feel vulnerable. It's okay to talk about it, because you'll talk your way through it. You know, and that's what I'm finding with Kalesi. The fact that she's 3,000 kilometres away and can't whack me across the head at the time is also a good thing, you know. So it's
yeah.
And she's got a much simpler, and I say this lovingly, she has a much simpler outlook on life. and then leave it.
Yes.
You know, because it is about family. You know, it's it is interesting watching her, her perception of what's important compared to what we think is important.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, the lesson out of the 42-year relationship is you're going to have to be vulnerable in this one.
Yeah.
Because the fear of being vulnerable in that first relationship, sure, what that does is that means that you don't actually practice it, and we understand that. But, of course, what it means is you could actually make the mistake of reproducing that by letting the fear of the vulnerability determine your behavior, and therefore you're not be vulnerable. So it's kind of like, you know, if it's going to be different, then you'll have to step in there and be different. Yeah, that can be that'll be challenging, because, you know, you're, as I said to you guys earlier, you know, that when I'm taking something to Mary that is likely to be contentious, and let's face it, you're most likely to be feeling vulnerable about contentious issues, then when I go to her, I either turn up really worried and like quite scared that it's all going to turn to shit, or I let it build up and then I turn up angry, and neither one of them is satisfactory.
Mm.
So that's a matter of practicing, getting on the front foot and getting stuff that I feel vulnerable about out in the open earlier. You know, the smaller it is, the sooner I go, the sooner I step up, then the easier the whole thing is.
Yeah.
That's after 45 years of being in a relationship where if there's anywhere I should feel safe, it'd be there. But that's a funny thing about being in a long-term relationship with someone, is that they know you better than anyone else. And so the person who can love you the most is also the one that can hurt you the most.
Yeah.
So we get pretty scared. Okay.
One of the things we talk about with the staff, particularly around difficult conversations, is difficult conversations aren't going to get any easier if you delay having them. The only thing that changes is you work yourself up. So get the difficult conversation out of the way as quick as you can.
Well, I think that what you just said in another way is difficult conversations are not going to get easier by waiting, but they are going to get worse.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you want this to be worse, leave it till tomorrow.
Yeah.
If you want it to be easier, talk now. Frightening thing for most people to hear.
Yeah.
So here's another quote from Brené Brown. No accident we're quoting from her work. I love the fact that she calls herself a shame researcher.
Yeah.
Not many people have bothered to go into that field or acknowledge that that's what she's actually researching in. So as a shame researcher, I know that the very best thing to do in the midst of a shame attack is totally counterintuitive, and that is practice courage and reach out. And I would... You know, those circumstances I was describing to you before about people standing up in front of a crowd and bringing a skeleton out of the closet is exactly that, is that it's counterintuitive, but they know they have to. So sharing is a really, really powerful concept. And I have seen groups of people get together and share where there is no practitioner like myself involved, where they can work it out themselves, where people who are willing to protect each other and be vulnerable and open and honest, and decide to not be judgmental and to create a safe space. There's another magical character that turns up that takes care of that whole thing. So even untrained groups of people can actually pull this off if they are willing to do what I said, which is, you know, be vulnerable, not judgmental, that kind of a thing. Strategy number 5 is practicing kindness. So therefore, it's very important that you remind yourself that you're entitled to make mistakes, that not only are you entitled to make mistakes, that when you do make a mistake, then what you need to do is extend forgiveness towards yourself. Because if you don't, then how are you going to do it for anybody else? And why is it that you will do it for others if you can, but not for yourself? So there are two levels to this. The first is understanding that mistakes are a part of life. And, you know, we're talking about Eloise, you know, we've been a bit quiet about her for a while, but, you know, she needs to understand that she's entitled to make mistakes. And in fact, we require that she does make mistakes. In fact, I just thought of an example. Some of you know Joanne Martin. So my friend Joanna, she used to be a doctor. Yeah. And when she got appointed to her internship in a hospital in Hobart, she realised that she was absolutely crap at getting cannulas into people's veins in their elbows. So she let it be known in the hospital that whenever there was a cannula needed to be put in, that the call had to go out to her, and on her radio mic or whatever it was that she had, she would get a call saying, you know, someone in ward such and such needs a cannula put in. And the nurses who were expert at it would hold back from doing it so that she could go and do it so she could practice. And while she might have inflicted some unnecessary pain on some patients, because she got better because of practice, because she got better by making mistakes, long term, she hurt less people and she developed a skill that couldn't be developed in any other way. So she had to fail her way to success by putting herself in. I think it's a classic example of being brave enough, like, you know, and saying, declaring publicly, I'm crap at this, so I want you to call me so that I can have the opportunity to stop being crap at this, is a fabulous way to tackle something. Because it's a demonstration of courage, and it's also a demonstration of determination to, or an illustration of determination to develop a skill that quite a difficult skill to develop. At the same time as we need to forgive ourselves when we make mistakes, we also need to reward ourselves when we succeed. And this is where I find lots of people kind of fall apart, is that they don't know what they would reward themselves with. And then they don't go about delivering the reward when they've earned it anyway. And, you know, it's a ridiculous concept when you think about it, you know, that I've said I'm going to do X, Y, Z and my reward is, you know, I'm going to go get a massage, but, you know, I haven't got around to it, been busy, you know, maybe I should save it for later, blah, 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 blah. There's a significant part of life missing when we don't include rewards, because what it means is if we don't include rewards, what we're only thinking about is punishment. So if there are two opposites, punishments and reward, then we need to actually focus more on reward than we do on punishment or forgiveness for bad behaviour. That makes sense to you guys?
Yep.
Cool. All right. That means that as your coach, I can say to you, what is the next challenge you've got on and what is the reward you're going to give yourself when you succeed? And you would have an answer to that. We won't do that right now because it's kind of important you work that out yourself. Strategy number six is to make sure you're not alone. So it's important that we understand that that it's a rare human being who doesn't need help at some point. You know, we can't know everything, even though we might expect ourselves to know everything. So the important thing about seeking help is recognizing that when we go seeking help, that this is not a sign of poor performance. This is not a sign that we are helpless or hopeless. This is, you know, a lot of people think if I've got to ask for help, it means that I'm hopeless and I can't do it. But the reality is seeking assistance is a whole lot smarter than not asking for help or guidance. And yet, you know, when Alan Peace and Barbary's wife published a book called Why Women Can't Read Maps and Why Men Won't Ask for Help, they hit a nerve, because don't worry about women and maps, but think about men not asking for help. Because men are competitive by nature, to ask for help is to admit that I'm not going to win the competition in whatever the competition is. So show me how to do this is kind of like, you know, I've lost count of the number of times that friends of mine, particularly men, have not asked me for help when they desperately needed it. And they knew that I could help. And they knew that I would help. But they just couldn't bring themselves to ask. And in fact, my next door neighbour, who is my best friend, when he does need help, will come in and ask for it because his wife sent him. Because he's been slaving away for hours trying to make something work. And eventually his wife says, just go and get Curly. And he'll come in and go, look, I don't mean to bother you. And if it's not a problem, and would you mind? It's kind of like, it's the most tragic form of asking for help you've ever seen, simply because of admitting that he's not able to do something by himself. So when it comes to support, A, we need to be good at asking for it, and B, maybe we need to have somebody online that, you know, has got some professional skills at that level, because maybe that can be a helpful thing. And maybe we need to get a reality check from time to time in terms of our plans and our goals by just referring outwards at some kind of a level to a friend or somebody who's close. You know, quite often I'll say to Mary, tell me if I'm thinking crazy, but I was just blah, blah, blah. And that's really kind of checking whether my thinking has gone off the wall or has become hopeless or whatever. And in fact, years ago, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, this gay couple came to me and they said, we're going to get married, but, you know, that's not legal in Australia. Can you perform the ceremony? And I go, okay, yeah, sure. So we do that. And afterwards they said, can we have you come around for dinner once a month? And I said, yeah, sure. What for? And they said, well, because we both think alike, we can both follow a thought pattern that just goes up a garden creek. It just goes up a creek where, you know, where there's no solution. And we just need someone who doesn't think like us to go through the whole process and just tell us we're dreaming, or that, you know, we ought to wake up to ourselves or change direction or whatever. And, you know, it's a staggeringly powerful piece of insight for them to say, the way we think is so alike that we could actually convince ourselves something bad is actually good. And they were smart enough to go, we just want to check external to ourselves. We need someone who gets it that, you know, we're not strange, someone who cares about us and loves us and supports us, but will tell us the truth. And I found it delightful to be able to go and just be with them and just share some time, have dinner, glass of wine, that kind of thing, and just hear about their deepest dreams and goals and what they thought would work and what wouldn't. And, you know, at one stage they said, we want to write a book, and we talked about what was going to be in the book. And just in that discussion, they discovered they didn't actually really want to write a book. They just thought they had to, or that it would be a good idea. But on closer examination, it just didn't make sense. So sometimes a referring out is one of the best things that we can do, particularly going to someone who's got no idea. In fact, I don't know if I told you guys this before, but the very first book that I wrote, I was feeling pretty much the imposter syndrome, because I was feeling like, you know, because this is going back a ways, I think that book came out in 1995, and when it was a manuscript, I was petrified. So I had so much imposter syndrome, you couldn't believe it, because I knew that there were people like Tony Robbins, and at that stage he hadn't even written a book. Tony Robbins had not come out with his first book called Awaken the Giant Within, which, talk about a great title and talk about a fabulous book. But he hadn't come up with that, so who was I to be writing a book? And I had lots of reasons why I could explain to myself why I shouldn't be the person coming out with the book. But nevertheless, there it was. So to check its veracity, what I did was I took it to some people I knew. I only knew them vaguely, but I knew they hated personal development. And, you know, they got on okay with me and Mary. They just didn't like what we did for a living. And they thought it was all bullshit. And I said, I want you to read this book because I need a reality check on the book. And so they read the manuscript and they bagged heaps of it and they said heaps of it was good. And that was really what I was looking for, was someone who was a completely, totally different point of view to look at it and tell me which bits held water and which bits didn't. That's just an illustration. Sometimes we need a reality check to kind of make sure that our rationale and our reasoning stands up, not just in our own ballywick, but elsewhere as well. That makes sense to you guys?
Yep.
Good with that, Sarah?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
All right. Anything stopping us going to number seven?
No, go for it.
Go for it. Okay, number seven is, what are you visualizing? What are you imagining? And the reality is that when we first started teaching personal development, this was a key piece of what we said to people, is you have to, first of all, not just think about it, but you have to be able to visualize it. You have to be able to dream it. You have to make movies in your head about what it would be like. In this case, we're talking about to be a non-imposter, to feel your place in the world. So that means, what would it be like to be living without self-doubt? And maybe, Sarah, this is what you put in front of Eloise, is, okay, so what would self-doubt be like? What would the actual experience be like? And, you know, how would it translate? What could you do that you can't do now? What would, because maybe it's just, she just needs to grab the picture in her own head. Certainly, when you hear John talking about traveling Australia for 12 months and then going and living in Fiji, I don't think too many people have trouble getting an idea in their head. And I specifically didn't ask John about how you're going to travel around Australia. It's not the subject of what we're doing today. But it's because I already have my own ideas about how I would do it. And so the movie in my head is already there. In fact, there's a movie in my head about living in Fiji, about what that would be like as well. Not too hard to imagine, you know, beautiful turquoise water and spearfishing and whatever. Lots of people would not have spearfishing as part of that visualizing. So how we visualize is not important. The purpose of visualizing is because what visualizing does, what making movies in our head does, is it triggers the piece of our subconscious that actually rewires. And the reason it does that is because visualizing triggers emotions. In other words, when I start imagining traveling around Australia, maybe me and Mary in a caravan, or maybe a, you know, camper van, or whatever, however that is going to be, then what happens is, from that perspective, is I describe we're going to go anti-clockwise or clockwise because of the places I want to go and the emotions that those places would trigger. And I would imagine that, or in part of my visualizing, would be lots of time in tropical waters where I'd be spearfishing, etc., but also lots of time in wineries where, you know, maybe we were bottling wine and packing it off somewhere to go into our cellar or whatever. So I have experiences that I imagine that are not actually just visualizing, they are little movies in my head that create emotions. And as we create that emotion, we create the link. And the link between our goal and our subconscious is critically important, because we're not going to make things happen until we're connected to them, until there's a powerful emotional draw to that. And that's why I ask people details that are not necessary. You know, when someone says to me, I'm going to do XYZ, I say, tell me more. Because I know that in them describing the details, they're connecting to the feeling. And it's the feeling that actually drives this thing. From that perspective, the only other question with God is, does it matter anyway? In other words, could John be happy with Khaleesi traveling around Australia or being in Fiji or doing something else? In other words, a lot of our goals and targets we think are going to make us happy. In reality, we might just be doing that thing and still be miserable. So right at the moment, I'm sitting here talking to you guys, but out the window, and you would both know this, you've both been here, outside the window is about, I don't know, 70 or 80 boats. I don't know how many million dollars worth of boats there are out there parked out the front in the marina. But what I do know, beyond any shadow of a doubt, is that every one of those boats was bought with a visualization process about how happy the owners were going to be out in their boat. Whether they're having a barbecue on the back of it, or whether they're swimming or fishing or whatever, there's some dream, there's some visualization, some movie happening. What I know, it's a reason I'm looking at these boats at the moment that are not out on the water, they're tied up. The reason I'm looking at them at the moment is that lots of people have had negative experiences on the boat. Not because of the boat, but, you know, a husband and wife are arguing before they got here. They jump on the boat, they're arguing on the boat, the weekend is miserable, and the boat made no difference. So when I say, does it matter anyway, really what I'm saying is, yes, a boat would be a lovely thing to have, but it's not going to make you happy. And neither is anything really. Whether we build a gigantic business or a small one or whatever it is, generally speaking, we do that because we want it to make us happy. In many cases, the whole link around imposter syndrome is, I want to be successful so I don't feel like an imposter. And I'm saying you can feel an imposter and have spectacular results. In fact, we started this session 4 or 5 hours ago by talking about Jennifer Lopez and Jodie Foster and Angela Mayu, all of whom have grown massive success and still felt like imposters. So therefore, there's a sequence here I'm talking about. You have to visualize what you want. You then have to imagine what it would be like to have that. And what is the emotion that goes with that? And does the thing that you're visualizing actually matter, or is it the vehicle for you to feel better anyway? That makes sense to you guys?
Yep.
Yeah, it does.
Pretty deep concept there.
So that last little bit you said actually is what finally sort of put it together for me. So your question is, does it matter anyway? And I'm looking at, you know, what would the lack of self-doubt feel like? And then when you said it's, or is it just the vehicle? And so that question part of, or that part of the question for me is what then identifies that what you're trying to visualize, what you're trying to move towards, is that about improving your emotions, improving your state, all those sort of things, as opposed to just putting another toy on the shelf that with empty promises.
Yeah. And, you know, really what I'm getting at here is that if we talk about Eloise, and hopefully she's listening to this sometime in the future, and we say, what would self-doubt be like? She might struggle to imagine it. So we say, okay, well, what would an example be? And she might say, well, you know, dealing with a situation that I've never come across before, you know, some kind of, you know, paramedic disaster or catastrophe or whatever, and being cool, calm, confident and collected. And we go, okay, got it. That's the feeling that you want. And that's well described. But does that matter anyway? Or could you still do it and just be a bundle of nerves while it's happening? And the reality is she could do it and be a bundle of nerves while it's happening. And that's usually how most people learn. When it comes to toys, yeah, that's pretty easy, you know. Does the boat matter? Not really. You know, you're going to have the boat or not have the boat. You're still going to have the same number of arguments and dislocations and problems and pieces of angst with, you know, whoever you care about at a deep level. So the stuff doesn't matter. So you're right about the toys don't matter. The reality is, for Eloise, she can decide to be confident tomorrow without any more practice, because the fascinating thing about feelings is that we imagine them. So Eloise has to imagine self-doubt, because your perception of her is that she's quite capable. So she can say, well, it's more real for me because I go to the job every day and I experience that. But given that we both know that she, you know, 5 years from now, she's going to be a wizard paramedic, what we know is that she's only possessed by that feeling at the moment, that that feeling is going to change. And that by the time she's been in the job for 20 or 30 years, she's going to be teaching other people, and she's going to be coming across exactly this thing. She's going to be teaching people then in the future who are her age now, and they're all going to be full of doubt, and she's going to be wanting to convince them it's going to be okay. You just have to turn up, have a go. Am I making sense?
Yes.
So yeah. From that perspective, what is it that causes her to change how she feels about it? And she's going to say experience. As a practitioner in this field, I'm going to say, no, what happens is you just change your mind. At some point, we just change our mind. The reality is we don't learn slowly. We learn at light speed. We change our minds quickly. We're just in love with the idea that's going to take 20 years to warm up to it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Cool. All right, if we look at number eight, then we're going to talk about, okay, so what about your thinking? So the reality is you can't always share your way out. Brené Brown would tell you to start that, and I would say continue with that as well. But there's a part of this that you can add to, and that is, you know, your thinking sometimes has holes in it. Sometimes it would pay to think a little bit differently. And, you know, once again, Eloise comes up in my thinking. I go, okay, she could think differently. She could think about, like, she could think like a non-imposter, because I'm sure that there are people her age in that job who are just, they don't suffer from the self-doubt that she does, but they don't have a better reason. They're not more intelligent. They're not more skilled. They're not more talented. Some of them will have less experience, and yet they're not feeling like an imposter. And that's really because of the way we think. And, you know, it's kind of like when you can think correctly, you can think your way into a better spot. So I talk about practicing thinking like a non-imposter. In other words, what does a non-imposter think like? And the thinking process, generally speaking, is that they understand that life has its ups and downs, that learning is like a roller coaster and you can't be brilliant all the time, and that if you can come to terms with that, everything's okay, and you're going to mess some things up, and you're going to, other things are going to go great. And like Joey that I was talking about, you know, the doctor who was practicing putting cannulas into people's elbows, she very quickly came to terms with the fact that she was hopeless at it, and there was only one way that she was going to get good at it, and it wasn't waiting for confidence to turn up. It was to actually dive in there, understand she was going to be the opposite of being brilliant all the time, but that one day she'd be brilliant, and one day she'd be teaching people how to do it. And that's exactly how it happened. In fact, what got Joey out of being a doctor was that she did everything. So by the time that she'd learned how to do everything, there was no more challenges. And so she hadn't been a doctor for 20 years. And that's because doctoring for her, and I'm not saying this is true for other doctors, but for her, the challenge went out of it. So she had to change industries, and changing industries brought a whole bunch of new challenges for her. I mean, think about it. This is about thinking. This is about the process of thinking rather than allowing your thoughts to dominate. In other words, the first thought that comes into your head, I can't do this. Yeah, okay, maybe. Yeah. But we could have a different thought, and that is, a different thought, for example, could be, I could have a go at it. Or another thought could be, if I don't have a go, I'll never learn. Or another thought could be, well, I'm just going to have to because everyone's watching. So there's probably 25 or 30 different thoughts we could have in any set of circumstances that are going to allow us to change our view of the circumstances and what's going on for us. And it's pretty important we come to terms with that. So I would suggest to everybody, be careful of your thinking. Quality thinking gets quality results. Shit thinking gets shit results. What most people do is they run with the first thought. And the first thought usually is about self-doubt. But it's just the first thought. It's not, it doesn't have to be the one we run with. Make sense?
Yep. To use a paramedic example for Eloise, if she's listening to this in the future, I've got a niece who always wanted to be a paramedic. She suffered from Crohn's disease. She's got a colostomy bag. Last year, she qualified as a special ops paramedic. One of there's only a handful of women in New South Wales get to be special ops paramedics. And you know, all of the stuff that could have stopped her didn't stop her because that's what she wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty awesome concept. I think that thinking is underrated, except when we use thinking to affect our feelings.
Yeah.
But when I think my way through a feeling, that's not going to work too well. Mm. But the rest of the time, thinking has, you know, how we think has a big impact on our life. Okay. Something to be aware of is that as you change, as you move away from imposter syndrome, as you become, you know, if I could say inverted commas, I'll do this, even though I can't see myself or you. If you move away, if you become if you move away from imposter syndrome, you become more confident. I say confident because, you know, what the heck does that mean? The thing to understand about becoming more confident is that your feelings are actually the last part of you that changes. In other words, I keep going back to Joey with putting the cannulas in. She's got to put a lot of cannulas in successfully before she starts to feel like she's got a reliable technique or she's got a reliable process or that she herself is reliable. In other words, the feelings, she could be banking a whole bunch of successes. She might go a whole week and never miss a vein. But it might not be until the end of that week that she's saying, I think I'm getting this. So an important thing for us to understand is that our behaviour will change, but our feelings about our inadequacies may take longer than our behaviour does, which is an extraordinary concept when you think about it. Add to that, that if you want to stop feeling like an imposter, then you're going to have to stop thinking like one. Then that means continuously thinking about what would happen if I had a go, etc. As a consequence of that, over time, you begin to run with the new thoughts. And as you begin to run with the new thoughts, then the feelings change. Like I said, those feelings are the last thing to change. So when you do that, you'll stop trying to overcome imposter syndrome and just use reframing to talk yourself down out of the tree faster. And what I mean by that is that you don't have to have an imposter life. You can actually have an imposter moment. And I think we've been working our way up for this for Eloise for all day. So, you know, pardon us, Eloise, for taking 4 or 5 hours to get to this. You're entitled to feel like an imposter, mate. You're entitled to feel full of self-doubt. But you only have to have that for moments. You don't have to have a life like that. It only has to be, you can just let it visit. It can be a temporary situation because everything in our life is temporary. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you're having breakfast, it's temporary because when you finish, you're going to get up and do something else. So everything we do is temporary. We go to work, but you're only at work 8 hours a day or 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 or whatever it is. So everything is temporary because we go to the next thing. And imposter syndrome should be exactly the same. It's something that we feel because there's probably good reasons to trigger it and we can easily run with that. But we don't have to stay in that position. You don't have to eat breakfast all day. You don't even have to have breakfast 3 times a day. You can move on. When you think about it, the real problem here, the real problem that we get to deal with is that we don't like feeling uncomfortable. And therefore, as a consequence of that, we will act to make ugly feelings go away. So if imposter syndrome is an ugly feeling, we will do whatever we need to do to make that ugly feeling go away. And that desire increases to the point of becoming a compulsion. And if having a cigarette makes the ugly feeling go away, trust me, you'll get hooked on the cigarettes. If having a beer makes it go away, then trust me, you get hooked on the beer. So if it's chocolate or shopaholic or workaholic or anything, then it becomes a compulsion because what it does, it takes the ugly feeling away. Therefore, after a while, we kind of go, let's just go straight to the thing that takes the ugly feeling away, even before the ugly feeling turns up. So I can be sitting around, not actually feeling too bad at all, thinking, let's go shopping, because the compulsion has now turned up as a feature in my life. I'm in the habit of it, and now I'm stuck. And I'm really stuck because I created the stuck. So instead of that, what we need to do is to turn towards these ugly feelings. It's not until we turn towards, in this case, feeling inadequate for the task or for the job or for the person or the situation. We have to actually go into that ugly feeling and seek to understand it, seek to explore it and see what it's made up of, and learn as much as we can about ourselves from that ugly feeling. Because if we do that, you know, if you allow the feeling to exist without letting the feeling get personalized, then what happens is we get the breakthrough. And breakthrough comes from turning towards a feeling staying one step removed from it, remaining the observer and watching what's going on for the person who's going through that feeling. What that will do is tell you, you know, okay, so you won't ask what you can do about imposter syndrome. Instead, what you'll do is you'll ask what you can do with imposter syndrome. Because the reality is, I've seen so many people in my life with imposter syndrome go and hit it out of the park that it's ridiculous. More people, the truth of life is, more people succeed in self-doubt than people who succeed because they're confident. The vast majority of success in the world is created by people who are acting despite the fact that they are racked with self-doubt and shivering with fear of messing it up. So it's not a question of making imposter syndrome go away and what can I do about this imposter syndrome. It's a question of, well, what can I do? And the imposter syndrome's in the background there anyway. If you are wanting to help somebody with imposter syndrome, then I'm going to suggest that number one, what you do is you be kind. Now, the reason I'm giving you this, the reason I'm saying if you want to mentor somebody with imposter syndrome, you want to help somebody get through it, that is a great piece of work for you to do. It's always instructive for ourselves to teach people in something that we've struggled with ourselves. It's always a great thing to do to pass on your learning and save somebody else the difficulty of going through it. But I'm really talking to you, because if you want to mentor you through imposter syndrome, you will do this to yourself as well. So the first step is the only step. That is, be kind. When you're helping somebody with imposter syndrome, understand you'll need to be kind because they feel vulnerable. They feel like they're not good enough. They don't need you adding to it. So tenderness and care is a critical part of helping somebody get through imposter syndrome. That means be kind to yourself. Second thing, normalize their feelings. Make sure that they understand it is okay. We all go through this. It is a normal thing. It is not unusual for you to be feeling this way. You are not strange and different and weird and unusual because you feel this way. This is a very, very common experience. As a professional practitioner in this field, I'm saying it's 9 out of 10 people common. But 90% of human beings feel this in some way, shape, or form, to some degree or another. Number three, when you're helping somebody get through imposter syndrome, make sure you go slowly with it, right? Don't ask them to progress faster than they are capable of, because you'll blunt progress altogether. So it's important that part of being kind is to progress at the speed that the client can handle. Number four, just gently challenge their perception, their reality. Just gently challenge the idea that they can't do it. Just gently challenge the idea that it's impossible, they can't do it, they never will be able to do it, they should not even try. Just challenge that from the point of view of what else they've learnt, what else they've taught themselves, and share your own story about when you've experienced doubt. Don't be too big on, but I got over it. Just share what you experience, because that's the part that people need to relate to, is, you know, that not what you did about it, but that you actually had it. Of course, you need to be non-judgmental. If you're judging people for being the way they are, you're not helping them. You're just joining in with all of the criticism they're expecting. And of course, you have to be gentle. And that's kind of like number one said in a different way. In fact, if you look at steps 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, they're all kind of a version of be kind. So we say be kind from the point of view of, you know, here's a bunch of ways of being kind when you're helping somebody get through something that they are struggling with. And you can say, you know, it's a funny thing, you know, people talk about being depressed and we go, but you've got no reason to be depressed. You know, you've got a house, you've got a roof over your head, you've got food on the table, blah, 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 blah. And we list off all the reasons why they shouldn't be depressed. That is very unkind. That is very unhelpful, because we're telling them they shouldn't be the way they are, but they know that they are the way they are. As soon as we recognize that they are the way they are, we're on their side instead of the enemy. Because when you demonstrate that you don't understand, then you also demonstrate you cannot help. So kindness is critically important. It's probably the most difficult thing to do, but it's worth it. In terms of this episode, we've been at this 4 or 5 hours. I know you didn't come this far to only come this far. that there is more depth, there is more you can understand about this, and you can go further down this road if you like. And the way to do that is to look at this material again. So Mary and Julie have prepared worksheets for you to work your way through. This is a different format. It's a different way to do the same material. There's no new material in here. There's a different way to review it. There's a different way for you to understand it. Some people just learn better when they have a pen in their hand and they're writing on paper. And if you're one of those people, then I'm going to suggest that you download these from the website and get, work your way through them as soon as possible, because there's a thing in education called spaced repetition. Spaced repetition means if there are small gaps between the repetition of a lesson, but the lesson comes in a different format than the first version, then that's the fastest way that people learn. Now, if you hear what I'm saying the fastest way for human beings to learn. A lot of people do a lot of research in this field. And what they're saying is spaced repetition is it. This is a version of spaced repetition. You repeat the stuff in a different format as soon as possible. That's one of the keys. So that's for you to do at your own time and your own pace. And here is a self-assessment exercise. So what you can do is you can look at where you are with this material and go, okay, so what I can do is I can rank myself. You'll see that there's a point scoring system there, and you can give yourself a score. Don't compare yourself to anybody else. Just compare yourself to yourself. So do this exercise again in 6 months and look at progress or otherwise, and use that, progress or otherwise, to determine your next steps in terms of, do you need more on this level, or have you got enough and you can move on to the next thing? And that, my friends, is a critically important thing to do. That's how you can make sure that you get the most progress from what we've done today. So that's it for today. What I want to do is say, any questions before we go, great being with you. So anything you wanted to hear again, or comments you want to make, or anything at that level?
Just a question, Paul, on when will the worksheets and the imposter syndrome chart be on the website?
I can't hear the second bit. Monday. You can. Okay, Julie's going to email it to you now, John.
Terrific, thanks.
Yeah, that's because she has your email address and she can do that.
Right, thanks, Julie.
Okay, thanks for that. Cool, any other questions?
Sorry,
Sarah.
Oh, I was just going to say no questions from me, but thank you so much. That was valuable.
Yeah, pretty cool session. I reckon this is something you don't see too much on out there, so... I'm really pleased to be able to present this stuff as, you know, something authentically new and different.
Definitely.
A one-on-two coaching session, which you normally don't get from you, Paul. So
there you go.
Yes, we're privileged.
It's been fun, though. Hey.
That's a benefit of Turn It Up.
There you go. That's, you know, there's 25 or 30 people in this program, and most of them listen to it later.
Yeah.
And, you know... To those 25 or 30 people out there who are in this program, it might have been good to be here today, but, you know, they're going to process it however you do. I think most people listen to this in 45-minute segments on the bus or whatever, on their phone or whatever. And, you know, how good is that, that we can get education that gets delivered to our phone for us to access whenever we want, which I'm going to recommend to you guys as well. Have a listen into this stuff again sometime in the future, not too far into the future, because you'll hear it differently.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thanks, Paul.
Pleasure. Thank you for being with us. Great to be doing a coaching session like this. It's a long time since I've done a five-hour coaching session. It's been worth it. Anyway.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.